Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 115. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And today we are talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, Season 1, Episode 4, I Plunge to My Death. This is the Echidna and Chimera discussion. Very excited to get into it.
Absolutely.
If you would like to contact us for any reason to give us your feedback on the show, anything at all, the podcast, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. You can also join Prophecy Radio Reading Room on Facebook, where we talk about books about mythology, whether or not they are from Rick or Rick Riordan Presents.
Just keep it PG-13.
Yeah. We just recorded episode 114, like an hour ago, because we have our screeners and Kristen's leaving for Disney, and so we had to pack it all into one day. And so I was like, we just won't have any news for episode 115. It's fine. Literally between the time we ended that episode and started this one, we now have 5 things to talk about.
Yep.
Like, that's how fast this fandom and the publicity machine moves.
Like, we covered all the news in the last episode. And we were like, we just won't have news. It's fine.
Yeah.
But there's always something.
Yeah, there really is. So we do have some news and updates for you this week. The first of which is that there is official Percy Jackson merch in the Hot Topic store at hottopic.com. It's not just the orange shirt that we've seen before. They have a black hoodie with the Camp Half-Blood symbol on it. They have the signs for Camp Half-Blood with all the gods. They have the Pen is Mightier Than the Sword, a Riptide shirt, a Waterland logo shirt, a Lotus Hotel Casino shirt, and a Yancey Academy shirt. And the designs are simple, but I don't hate them.
Yeah, I also don't hate that hoodie, although I don't like hoodies that much, so put it on a crew neck. But I love the black with the orange.
Yeah,
it's really
so
striking, really cool.
I actually have a hoodie just like that that my boyfriend got probably from, like, I don't know, Amazon or something.
Right, Etsy.
Not official,
or something, yeah.
Yeah, but I like the black and the orange.
I like the Lotus Hotel shirt. I mean, it's purple, which is like a thing.
Yeah.
I love purple. But I really kind of like the design on that. Waterland is cool too.
It'd be cool to wear it and just be like, oh, where's the Lotus Hotel? You don't want to go there. I had a terrible time.
Trust me.
Yeah.
It's one of those secret fandom shirts, which I love. I'm all about secret fandom, like wearing a Star Labs t-shirt, and people don't really know that it's fandom-y unless they know. And so, yeah, I love this kind of stuff where they just do other logos.
Yeah.
It's very fun. And right now they're buy one, get one half off, which it probably won't be that way by the time you listen to this.
Yeah, that's true. We're recording this a couple of weeks in advance.
Just a little.
Yeah. Disney at shopdisney.com has a couple of pieces of merch. They've got the orange Camp Half-Blood shirt as well, plus a, like, Zeus and Hera and Poseidon and Demeter and Ares, you know, like the listing of all the gods and their symbols.
I was going to say it has all the symbols on it too, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is interesting, especially considering all of the research I just did on astrological symbols, because go read that article if you haven't already about the artwork at the end of the episodes, the end credits sequence. You'll know why I was doing research. And there is a Camp Half-Blood We Are Unbreakable shirt, which I like that. I don't really like the design,
and
if I'm being honest.
And it's got all the symbols in white over the little bar.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It's got all the godly symbols. I don't love it. I feel like they could have done better. First of all, We Are Unbreakable should be like, you are not broken. Like, make it Sally's quote.
Yeah.
As opposed to,
well,
We Are Unbreakable.
Yeah. Well, she says we are unbreakable in the first episode.
True.
But the whole, like, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't love the word camp. I feel like It's a weird font. Yeah. But I like the impression of it. I like the colors. I love the Pegasus. Like, I like the detail on it.
But I like the idea. I don't like the execution.
Yeah. But I would imagine this is just the very beginning.
Yeah.
And these may have been there for a while, and I just noticed.
Yeah. Not sure. But if you didn't know, now you know.
Exactly.
They are also releasing posters for each episode of the show. And so episode one features Percy in his Yancey Academy outfit with the New York skyline in the background, the statue of Perseus holding Medusa's head. I can see Chiron. I can see the Minotaur. He's gripping his pen, and there's lightning all around the edges. It's pretty cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
And the second episode has Percy in his Capture the Flag uniform with Grover and Annabeth in the background. And then we see the bathroom, the destroyed bathroom. And
is that the big house or the Hermes cabin?
That has symbols on it.
I think it's the Hermes cabin.
Yeah.
And you can see his trident
right next to his
arm. Yeah.
Also, I love how it makes him look, like, heroic in his armor. Where he was, like, the least armored person out there for the flag, so I just love that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And there's, like, trees and stuff in the background, so really excited to see the poster for episode 3.
Yeah, definitely.
Medusa. I think that's going to be really cool. The last bit of news is there is apparently an official track list for the Percy Jackson and the Olympians soundtrack. This comes from Film Music Reporter, who is the same outlet that reported the release date for the soundtrack, which is December 22nd. And I'm just going to run through the titles here really quick. It says, one, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and it specifically says Bear McCreary after it, so this is like the theme. Two is Perseus, three is the Minotaur, four is Camp Half-Blood, five is Auntie M, six, the Mother of Monsters, seven, Chimera, eight, the Tunnel of Love, nine, a Zebra in Vegas, 10, Spirit of the Sea, 11, the Fields of Asphodel, 12, Lord of the Dead, 13, Poseidon, 14, Olympus, 15, The Lightning Thief, and 16, The Sea Does Not Like to Be Restrained.
I mean, I'm just saying they're releasing this in December after the second episode has aired, because you're getting it.
Right.
There's a lot of spoilery tracks there. I mean, like, it's not going to have spoilers in it.
Yeah.
But, like, you're going to get to hear...
It's a roadmap of what's happening.
Yeah. You're going to get to hear the music that's going to be going on behind some of these very iconic moments later in the series. So, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah. I'm really interested in checking that out. So, we'll definitely go through the music at some point. Whether it's a separate discussion, I'm not sure yet. But check it out. Comes out December 22nd. All right, I want to get right into our discussion for today, which is Percy Jackson and the Olympians, episode 4, I Plunged to My Death. This was this is a fairly pivotal, I feel like, moment where he meets Echidna. Echidna's kind of a big deal. The Chimera is very scary. We were really looking forward to seeing the Chimera in all of its glory. And I will say our first impressions of the episode was that it was too short.
Yes.
I feel like, you know, we were taking notes, and I had to pause it a couple of times. I'm like, I can't write fast enough. Like, so much happens.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of time to stop and breathe, which I don't mind, but I was really disappointed that it ended where it did, because I feel like it was a transitionary episode between Medusa and everything that was kind of set up there, and then what's going to be happening next, which is us meeting Ares.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did feel a little transitionary. Still a great episode, still a lot going on. It is our first chance to see the St. Louis Arch and, like, see that sequence actually play out. So, like, that was very exciting. But, yeah, it was a little on the short side. And let's face it, we all want these episodes to just be an hour long and we want all of the things. But for 33 minutes, they definitely pack a lot of story into that time. But, yeah, I kind of do wish that it had gone on a little longer. We saw just a little further and that wasn't pushed into the next episode. But beggars can't be choosers, and we still love it, and it's still great.
What they gave us was really good. I'm not disappointed at all by anything that happened in the episode, and there is actually, like, a change to kind of the circumstance that I'm really impressed by and that I really like, but I just wanted more to happen in this episode, and I feel like they could have found a way to get some more stuff in there, but, you know, we don't know their budgetary restraints, and maybe this was literally all they could do, given how great that chimera looked. Maybe they were like, we can't have too much of it on screen.
Like, listen, folks, as much is in there as we possibly can, this is where we had to draw the line.
So the episode starts with a flashback of young Percy being afraid to swim in the water, and this was so interesting to me because you kind of would think that as a son of Poseidon, even if he doesn't know that, that maybe he would have a natural affinity for water, but he was afraid to do it.
Maybe it's because it was a pool?
Maybe.
Like maybe if she took him into the ocean, he would have just kind of run in and been a little braver, but because it was a deep artificial pool, like it didn't feel the same, maybe? Yeah. I don't know. Interesting, though.
And you can tell that Sally's getting really frustrated that he's refusing to let go of the wall. And she specifically emphasizes that this is an important skill for him to know, that it could be really dangerous to live his life without knowing how to swim. And she also implies that she might not be around forever. And that in itself broke my heart.
Yeah.
Because obviously we're thinking, okay, Sally has disappeared. We know that she's probably in the underworld. At this point in the story, we don't really know whether or not she'll be able to come back. And so it's kind of like she really isn't there anymore.
Right. Well, and you can feel like she's like, she knows what's coming for him down the pike. Like at this point, she's probably, you know, they've started to kind of pay attention to what's going on around Percy. I'm sure they've warned her that as he grows, as he gets older, things might, you know, get scarier. Monsters might show up. You know, like, I'm sure she has some inkling of something that's going to come ahead.
Yeah.
And knowing Sally Jackson, in her head, she's playing out, well, nothing's going to hurt my kid if I'm still breathing. Like, she's thinking, like, if I have to die to save this kid, I will. And I'm going to make sure that he has all the skills he absolutely needs to survive without me. And, like, I can see her being the kind of mom who's like, you're going to be prepared. That's why I'm taking you to the Met and explaining your history. In case I'm not here to tell you about it, you're going to have a basis to draw from when you need to know things. Because Percy, so far on this trip, may not have all of the immediate answers of how to be a demigod, but he has the history. He knows Medusa's story. He knows, you know, who the Furies are. He's played Mythomagic with Grover, and he's able to identify the Minotaur on sight. Like, he's got the knowledge. He just doesn't have the new, like, you're a demigod, here's your powers, here's the shorthand you need to know, how do you live in this world kind of stuff. So, yeah, I love how they're keeping Sally a part of the story.
Yeah.
Despite her being gone and not really being an active part of this book past the first five chapters or so.
Right.
Because she's just such an important figure for Percy. I love that we're getting these little flashbacks.
I think that they did a really good job of, you're right, pushing Sally to the forefront of the story once again because of Percy's relationship with her. That's really important. The fact that this whole episode is about mothers taking care of their children. We start off with Sally and Percy. We end with Echidna. And, I mean, parents and their children, too. We get the whole plot line with Athena and Annabeth. We get Poseidon having always looked over Percy. There's a lot of, like, full circle moments in this episode, which was really well done.
Also, the two-word sentence,
breathe, mommy.
Have completely destroyed me.
Yeah.
Because it's just so sweet and pure coming out of little Percy's mouth.
Yeah. We were like 60 seconds into the episode and I was already tearing up.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. And Asriel Dahlman's like big eyes and just the way, yeah, that he says, just breathe, mommy, was a lot to handle. It was maybe too much for me. And he also specifically says, you'll always be there, which of course is very tragic in its own way.
Yeah.
Interestingly, a whistle blows and young Percy, not older Percy, is kind of thrown into one of the visions that older Percy has been having. And so you really have to wonder, like, did he have this vision when he was this young? Did current Percy have this, but he's just, like, in his younger body? What exactly is going on there?
Well, also, the next thing we see after that, the vision, is Percy laying in the train. So, like, if he was asleep and was dreaming about his mom and remembering this day in the pool,
right,
and then it flips, he may have stayed as young Percy in the vision because that's what he was seeing.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up after the vision shakes him awake, and that's when he starts talking to Annabeth. So I'm wondering if it's not just like a through line, his brain just shoved baby Percy into that vision.
Yeah. The background was really interesting to me because he is once again in the desert, which is where he was in the last one, and it keeps making me think of, like, oh yeah, throw Percy into the desert and, like, what can he do, you know? And I kind of feel like it's meant to be that isolating and that scary, like, he is totally powerless here. But I also thought it was significant that it's now daylight. The last two times, it was in the night.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been less and less water, and also it's growing brighter. And so, like, is this, you know, things are being revealed? Like, what is the significance of the time change?
Also, like, I'm trying to kind of picture, Percy's always looking off in, like, the same direction at the person talking to him, and then in the background, like, in the first vision, there was a lighthouse, there was a house, there was the beach, whatever. So I feel like he's like, you're losing things with every vision, and then, yeah, so, like, I don't know if the water, like, it feels like he's in the same place, it's just the water disappeared first, so we thought it was a new location.
Oh.
But it might still be that same spot, it's just things are changing around him with every vision.
Yeah.
It's weird, definitely.
And we get the same figure in that billowing kind of raggedy cloak with the lantern. We get the big pit with the sand and dirt falling into it in the background. And the figure says a lot of things about being a hero, being a forbidden child, and that sort of thing. But he also specifically says, she is coming. Now, when I first heard this, I was like, who is this person talking about? Because she is coming is not in reference to Zeus or Ares or Kronos. And I was like, Gaia? Because, like, that's the only, like, big female character that, like, could be really scary. But that's Heroes of Olympus. And there's no way they're planting those seeds that early. This is meant to be about Kronos. And then, of course, the episode is about Echidna, so they have to be talking about Echidna.
That's my guess.
The interesting thing to me is, this is kind of the first time where I felt like this was a genuine warning to Percy. Like, wake up, be prepared, she's coming. And if that's the case, who's speaking to him?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have so many questions. I feel like I'm missing something so obvious, but, like, just, there's not enough things that line up to, like, pinpoint it to this is definitely what's happening.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because the first two felt very creepy and scary and, like, seemed like they were supposed to be foreboding, this is a bad guy in the distance, whatever. And with the second vision with the black, like, pit kind of forming and the sand falling, it really felt like it was leading us to Kronos, like, this has to be Kronos. But in this episode, you're right, like, it's more of a warning, and it wakes him up. So, like, is this really Kronos, like, giving Percy a heads up that something's coming his way, you know, that doesn't quite sit for me. Like, unless he's foreboding about something coming, like, some lady, apparently, coming for him, which doesn't really track with what happens in the rest of the book.
So, it could still be Kronos, because Kronos wants Percy on his side. If Zeus sent Echidna after Percy, then Kronos would want to save Percy from Echidna. And if they had been in that carriage when she came through, they all three of them would have died.
Probably, yeah.
So this could still be Kronos, but he's actually warning Percy because he's trying to recruit him.
That is definitely true.
That makes the most sense,
yeah, I think. Yeah, so at probably, this point. I would say it probably is still Kronos.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
I know. Percy is awake now. We're back in the present day, and him and Annabeth are chatting on the train, and he basically asks about Thalia, and Annabeth talks about her in such an interesting way. There's a lot of respect and sort of longing, but there's also this, like, you know, Thalia, like, she describes her as, like, she was tough. She didn't care that she was a forbidden one, and she made Annabeth earn her respect and friendship. And Percy makes a joke like, oh, is that what you're doing? And Annabeth is kind of like, yeah, like, you need to earn it. And I love that she, it sounds almost like she wasn't super close to Thalia, at least not right away. Like, Luke instantly accepted her, Thalia took some time, but she really respects Thalia, and she's, I feel like, she's modeled herself after her in a lot of ways.
I was gonna say, it's definitely like, she's kind of a little bit in awe of Thalia. I would say that Thalia, in her absence, has become a bit of a almost mythical hero to her. Like, Thalia did no wrong. Thalia never screwed up. Thalia never would have done it. Like,
she's met a hero's fate.
Right. Like, she is the pinnacle of what, you know, you should strive to be. If you have to die in this world, it should be, you know, you should be suffering a hero's fate, not dying nonsensically because of something. Yeah, I feel that definitely. That line about, is that what you're doing with me? Like, do I have to earn your respect and your friendship? And she's like, yes. Percy goes on to kind of talk about how he thinks it's, like, garbage that the mythical world that he's now a part of, you have to earn love and respect. And he says something about, like, the people who are supposed to care about you force you to earn it. Like, that's not how it's supposed to be. Like, he's so used to his mother, who is the only person in his life who really cares about him, you know. He's so used to her giving that so freely and just respecting and trusting him and, you know, showing him all the love she possibly can, that he does not understand this whole, the gods will respect you when you give them, you know, the proper accolade, when you show them what you're willing to do for them, when you earn enough glory for them to pay attention to you. Like, he's just, that's why, I think that's part of why Percy keeps kind of just assuming that people talk to their parent. It's a godly parent, but it's still your parent, so they should want to talk to you, they should care about you. So, like, yeah, he's really having some trouble adjusting to the new standard for parenting and friendship and whatever. But I like how he kind of sees things and is like, y'all are twisted, it's not me. Like, this is not cool. And Annabeth's like, that's just how it is, dude. Yeah. Like, you're gonna have to get used to it.
And he specifically says, people who are close to you aren't supposed to treat you that way. And for Annabeth, she's been a part of this world since she was 7. This is really, I mean, and you don't even form memories, like, much earlier than that. So, like, this is all she's known for so long. And I think because she is a child of Athena, because she is a bit of a perfectionist, she wants to earn that respect from Athena. And this is actually a really good transition into the way that Annabeth thinks, because she kind of pushes back against Percy a little bit. And, like, honestly, I'm on Percy's side. Like, this is not the way to treat your children. I know that they're gods, but, like, do better. And I like that Percy is the one who is questioning the gods, you know? Like, he's not quiet about it either. Like, you can tell even Luke doesn't like the way the gods act, but he doesn't really say the quiet part out loud. Like, he's doing stuff in the background, but he's not pushing back as loudly as Percy is.
And I mean, Luke, Annabeth, Grover have all said, like, Percy, you can't say that to a god. You can't say that to Mr. D. You can't ask your father things like that. You have to, like, they're all kind of telling him, you don't say that part.
And so Annabeth kind of goes into a little bit of her backstory. She talks about how she was a literal gift to her father. She was born from a thought from Athena's mind. And her father loved her and took care of her and cherished her until he met a woman and they had kids. And all of a sudden, she wasn't a gift. She was a problem. And she says something truly heartbreaking, which is like, it's not just the gods who treat you that way. It's everybody, because that is what she has experienced in her life. And she says, the gods are easy. You show them respect and they'll help you. For her, it's very black and white. It's very straightforward. And like, and even though I just said that about Percy, like, there's a part of me that is like, I love the easy answer. I love the do this, you get this result every time. That's the anxiety talking. Just so you know, if you relate to that, you're probably anxious. But I understand where Annabeth is coming from with that.
Yeah, I have the quote written down because it kind of jumped out at me. Annabeth says, at least with the gods, you know the rules. Show them respect and they'll be in your corner no matter what.
Yeah.
How much foreshadowing?
Like,
this was the second time we watched it, and we took notes the second time, and so we had just seen it. And listening to this line, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Like, we literally, by the end of this episode, see this in action.
Yeah.
Where Annabeth broke a rule, and Athena says, you're on your own, kid.
Yeah. Like, and that's not in the book, and that's something added, like, that consequence, I think, is so important to show. So I'm really glad that they put that in there.
Yeah, because I think the spirit of that is in the books throughout. They just use other ways to kind of demonstrate it. And here, weaving it into this, just gives us explanations for why they're not going to just ask Athena and she magically heals Percy. Like, it gives... it gives you more motivation for the things that happen in the book to happen. It just smooths the way.
Mm-hmm. And I also, just to go back to that quote too, like, Annabeth loves architecture. She loves math. This is like a math problem to her. Show them respect. You get this result every time. And so that just makes so much sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to point out that she's wearing like a little bandana slash, like, it's not like a bonnet, but it's, you know, while she's sleeping, she has something covering her hair. And that is a detail that I feel like is so important to have in there, because it's so normal for, you know, black hair to need that when you go to sleep. It's something that maybe the white creators wouldn't have thought of. I'm really curious if Leah brought that up or who brought that up to make sure that it was like realistic to what she would actually be doing as a young black girl going to bed.
Yeah, especially because like they lost their packs at the beginning of the last episode with Medusa. So like they lost their backpacks, and so anything she had with her, she may have had her bonnet or something, and she's making this work because this is what she has to work with. So like I liked the inclusion of it too. And if you look at it, I'm not entirely sure, because when you zoom out, it just looks like a pattern. But when you, like, look at it close, it kind of looks like sheep.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, like, a true thing or if I'm just imagining the sheep.
It looked like sheep to me.
But, like, it looked like a little sheep pattern. I just thought that was really cute.
Yeah, so did I. Grover wakes up because they're talking too much, and he is super grumpy. I have never heard Grover act like this before, and it was so funny. It added a lot of levity to that scene.
Oh, yeah. And I love that Annabeth uses it as one last opportunity to get a dig in on Percy.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't traveled with him before. Like, oh, I have. Mm-hmm. Many a time. He's grumpy.
But it didn't sound as malicious as it did in the past.
No.
It sounds a little friendlier now.
But it's just a little more like... See?
Yeah.
I have more experience with this.
Yeah.
Just a little. Just enough of a, see, I told you kind of thing.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
But it's good-natured, and you can tell throughout this episode they are kind of building a little bit of a friendship. And Grover decides he's too grumpy, he needs to eat, and that's how they get out into the main carriage, basically.
Also, Annabeth thinks that Percy was, like... pampered being at boarding school. She calls them
froofy
boarding schools. And I'm just sitting here thinking through, like, all of the stories we have of Percy in school.
Yeah.
And, like, how he just literally bounces from, like, fight to fight, even in the next book and the book after that.
Yeah.
Like, it's just boarding school fight, blow up the building, move on to the next kind of thing. Like, it's not all that froofy in about.
Yeah. But also, she was living on the streets for a while, so
to her, super froofy.
Yeah.
Just hilarious.
So, while they're eating breakfast, we get this really fast scene of this ball of, like, what initially looked to me like this molten silver, glowy, like, weird thing kind of... punch a hole into the train that they're on. And we know now that this is Echidna and the Chimera. And she comes from the sky like the Minotaur did. So assuming that Zeus sent her...
Yeah, like from a distance, if you look at this from the beginning of the shot, you see this tiny little speck of light way off in the sky. And she zooms in and into the train. So... I think it's safe to assume that this is coming from Zeus.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's two, you know.
Yeah.
The Minotaur definitely came from Zeus. And if she did too, then that's two. And it would illustrate Kronos warning she is coming, like Zeus has her next on deck for you kind of thing. So.
Yeah. So we don't really get the resolution to this just yet. And it goes back to the kids. And Percy's like, okay, I have a dumb question. And Annabeth says... it's like you need me to make fun of you. And I know for a fact this is going to get memed and gift. It's going to go all over the internet. Persebeth people are going to love this so much. And you know what? I'm ready for it because it's hilarious. And Percy brings up a pretty fair question, actually, because he's like, look, I've never been to LA. I don't think you guys have been to LA. How are we supposed to get to the underworld? And... Grover is like, we need to take this one step at a time. That is too far in the distance. Nobody can see that far ahead. Let's just get to the next step.
Like, listen, Percy, that's just navigation. We'll figure that out.
Yeah.
Like, we can ask people, we get directions, we do something. Like, we'll figure it out. But, like, that's the least of our worries until we're there. Makes sense.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah. I don't blame Grover for feeling that way because all of this is very overwhelming. So, like, what else are they supposed to do? You know, do the best you can. And sometimes when you have a lot of anxiety, the best thing to do is just look at the next step. Don't look at, you know.
Yeah, 37 steps ahead.
Or if you're in Frozen, the next right thing.
Yeah.
That song made me sob in the theaters,
same.
FYI.
So much same.
So, Percy starts asking about the prophecy, but gets distracted by a small herd of centaurs, wild centaurs, outside of the train. And you said it looked like they were a family.
It might have been. It kind of looked like two of them were a little older, and two of them looked a little shorter, a little smaller. At least the human part of them did. So, it made me wonder if this wasn't two parents and their children. Like, there aren't... Because Grover goes on to say, like, there used to be large natural herds of centaurs, like, all over the place, and they aren't anymore because of humans and because of humankind. So, like, it makes me wonder if these small herds do still exist because they're able to kind of fall into, like, the mist and be a normal family, quote-unquote, or something. Because, yeah, it looked like their human halves were, like, wearing normal human clothing, too. So it wasn't like, you know, they were super wild or something. Yeah. I have no idea. Do wild centaurs wear clothes? I have no idea.
I mean, all we really know about is the party ponies,
right?
Really.
Exactly. So, yeah. I have no idea if that. But, yeah, it kind of looked like they might be a family.
Yeah. And you're right. Grover talks a lot about how they're going extinct. And this is clearly something that Grover is very passionate about. And is something that will come up later in the episode that I'm very interested to kind of dissect a little bit. But he also takes this opportunity to bring up Pan and the fact that Pan disappeared, and that because of it, humans have been chipping away at the wild, and that the satyrs have gone out searching for Pan and none have ever returned. And we kind of come back to Uncle Ferdinand as being one of those searchers. So I really like that they worked in Pan in this little conversation. It's part backstory, part exposition, part foreshadowing in the middle of, like, everything else that's going on. And I think it was very clever the way that they sort of slipped that in there.
Agreed, yeah. A little sprinkling of Pan mentioning now is going to pay off dividends down the end.
Yeah.
In the end, down the line. I don't know. I just smushed those together. But, like, yeah, that's such a pivotal part of Grover's story. I think kind of sprinkling those mentions in will help a lot later on. Mm-hmm.
And Annabeth also goes back to what Percy was asking about with the prophecy, specifically, you know, the end of the prophecy where it says they'll fail to save what matters most in the end. And she explains how prophecies work and how they're hard to understand. And the more you try to understand it, the harder it is. Actually, you wrote down that quote, which was really good.
Yeah, the harder you work to understand, the harder it gets to understand. And then she says, sometimes you just gotta let it come to you when it's ready.
Yeah.
It's very true. And I think she's trying to just get across to him, like, there's, you know, there are things you can control and things you can't. You can't control what the prophecy is actually about, but you can control how much you think about it and let it steer your movement. Like, do what you think is best, do what you think is gonna get you to where you need to be, and let the prophecy take care of itself.
Yeah. And I think that, again, they, like, because we didn't stay on the prophecy a whole lot after we saw it. And I think that it was important to kind of bring it up again, remind us about it, remind us how it works, explain to Percy how it works in this little moment of downtime between when something major kind of is about to happen. So.
And it is the kind of thing that Percy is going to have rolling around in his head anytime he's got a minute to think, because, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. And to him, he's thinking the thing that matters most, you know, like, is that my mom? Is that the quest? Is that, you know, he immediately starts talking about how the quest is doomed to fail. But, like, there's a lot at stake here and a lot going on, and you never know how things are going to change before you get to the end of this. So who knows what will matter most by the time we get there?
Yeah, exactly. They are interrupted by an officer who asks for their tickets. And I wanted to bring up the fact that I'm pretty sure this is the moment, or like right before this would have been the moment where they would have met Gladiola, the poodle from the book. And so there is no poodle.
No.
In the show, which is a little disappointing, but at the same time, the face-off with Echidna and the train scene, I think, is a lot more exciting, because in the book, they turn in this lost dog for the money to kind of head further west.
Yeah.
But I like that they switched this out, even though I was a little disappointed that, like, we're not gonna get Gladiola.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing. But yeah, they can't work every teeny minute detail into the show, so I can see why they made this change, and it works with the story.
But then again, you know, to play devil's advocate here, Hades' advocate, I don't know if that would be more appropriate, but this episode was so short. I think it would have been really interesting to have them do that with the dog. We would have learned that Grover is capable of speaking to the dog, and that is how they would have gotten money to get the train ticket.
Yeah.
So you still could have included that and kept everything else. So I think it would have worked, and I'm curious why they decided not to, if maybe, again, for budgetary reasons rather than time reasons.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they cut it.
May have, yeah.
The officer takes them back to their cabin, which has been absolutely destroyed.
Totally. Absolutely.
And the officer is like, we have a witness who says that they heard commotion and that they heard children's voices and all that kind of stuff. And Annabeth goes, are we under arrest? And the officer says, I don't think you want to take that tone with me, little girl. And Annabeth's face could melt skin from bone, the
like,
glare she gives him.
So very quickly.
Yes. And like, I mean, I've seen a lot of Annabeth from the book in Leah, but in this moment, that fierceness, I was like, she can really do it all. She can do subtle, she can do those emotional moments, she can be kind of funny, she can be really fierce. Oh, man, I mean, we're so lucky to have her.
Oh, yeah, she's incredible. And that was just one of those moments, like, excuse me? But yeah.
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 So she again repeats, you know, like, are we under arrest? And then immediately cuts to them sitting at the table, clearly in trouble.
Yeah.
And Percy wonders if the officer might be a werewolf. But Annabeth didn't think so. Like, Annabeth kind of called immediately that he was probably mortal, which,
yeah,
you know, we've already seen that she's capable of kind of picking monsters out.
Yeah.
And this woman, the witness, comes over to their table and joins them. And this is, of course, Echidna. I think if you've been following any of the casting, then you know Suzanne Cryer is Echidna. And she's so nice and so creepy at the
yeah.
same time. It's that, like, overly effusive niceness that makes you feel a little uncomfortable.
It's like when people from the South bless your heart. Like,
yeah.
It's that same, like, hidden venom kind of thing.
Yeah, like, you can tell, like, she doesn't really mean it. And that, like, she's building up to, like, cutting you down.
Yeah.
But you cannot fault her for anything she's saying in that
right.
moment.
Yeah. Like, it sounds like she's being pleasant, but you can feel that there's something not right going on. And, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she talks a lot about being a mom. She's like, you know, I know you guys are afraid, blah, blah, blah. And she mentions being a mom. And again, that kind of circles back to, like, Percy. And just the idea of, like, parents in general in this episode, which I think is, like, the major theme here. And she specifically calls her dog Precious, which I thought was cute. And this is different from the book, because in the book she calls the Chimera Sunny or Sun, and we learn in this episode that the Chimera is actually female. So they did change that.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't change anything. And
no.
also I think the name Precious for a Chimera is a lot funnier than Sunny. So
yeah.
Grover, oh, MVP Grover, he spots the glass on her jacket, and he also noticed that the glass was smashed inward, not outward, which means something came in and didn't try to, like, get out. And this could have, they could have easily given this to Annabeth, because she is the really analytical one. She's child of Athena. She notices these things. But they give a lot of great moments to Grover, where he's the mature one, he's kind of the stable one, he's the one keeping them together, and he has a lot of knowledge. And I think that it's so easy to give that to Annabeth because of who her mother is, but it makes a lot of sense to also give those lines and moments to Grover, because he's been living his life as a satyr for 24 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's known this.
Yeah.
So I loved that.
I did too. Yeah. I really liked that he was the one to kind of piece it together and to kind of have the forethought to look at the glass, to look at the window, to take a note of what it all looks like, so that when, you know, when confronted with the person who more than likely did it, he kind of has a moment to put all of it together.
Yeah. And Echidna says to them, this isn't your fault, but sadly, you're gonna have to bear the burden of your parents' mistakes today. And this reminded me a lot of what Medusa said to the trio, the fact that she was like, you know, you can choose to be something other than your parents, but since you're not, you're choosing to be like them, I'm going to punish you. And so, again, Echidna kind of brings this up, and they don't really go into the reason why she might hold a grudge against their parents or anything like that, other than the fact that, you know, they're demigods and she's a monster. And this was actually really interesting to me and something that I'm glad that they put in the show, because she kind of says, monsters like me? Of course they're like me. They were my children. And that's when we find out that she is Echidna, mother of monsters. And she talks about how this has always been a family story. She mentions that her grandmother was Percy's great-grandmother. She basically wants to stand in the way of monsters like them, which are demigods. And if you think about it, demigods are the monsters to monsters.
Yeah. The only difference, and this is what I would have said to her if I were in that train car, is then why do we die and you rebuild?
Yeah.
Like, that's the only difference between a quote-unquote monster and a demigod. Mm-hmm. Is if a demigod dies, they die. They go to Asphodel. They have a chance at rebirth, but, you know, it's a lot more complicated than if you're a monster who goes to Tartarus, and it's, you will reform, and you will come back. It's just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is, like, the only, like, supremely different, you know, thing about the two. And, I mean, we just met and saw Medusa, who is definitely a quote-unquote monster, but a different kind of monster, you know? So, like, it's all variations on a theme. Like, you're seeing all the different kinds of monsters in the world, and Echidna definitely comes across as a monster.
Right.
Like, pretty easy to point it out.
Yeah. You know? But if you think about it from her perspective, these demigods are running around day and night killing her children. That is not something that she's going to stand by. And so I like that it gives you a little peek at her perspective and kind of shows her in a different light. She is obviously the adversary, the antagonist in this episode. But even if you don't feel any sympathy from her, you can still understand where she's coming from. And that's the mark of an interesting villain.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So Echidna is chatting them up because she wanted them to be afraid, because the Chimera is young and still basically in training, and it will help the Chimera kind of zero in on them.
Well, I gotta say, we'll see the Chimera in a little bit. If that's a pup,
yeah,
I don't want to see the adult ones.
Yeah, it was huge.
It's big.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And she says, that's what a good mother does for her children. Not that you would know. Ouch. Ouch.
And that's definitely her talking to Annabeth.
Yeah.
Like, she, you know, I don't know if she knows Percy's mom, but, like, that's to Annabeth.
Yeah. I mean, that was a cutting remark.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it cut to the bone.
Yeah.
But 1 point to Echidna. It was pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
It was really good.
Definitely. Yeah.
The Chimera's tail shoots out of the little bag that it's in and it stabs Percy with a barb in the chest. And Annabeth pretty much immediately attacks. Like, I think it goes to grab her next and she's lifted up, but then she slams down because she already has her knife at the ready.
Question.
Yeah.
Is that the bit from the trailer where we saw Annabeth stab?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I thought so, but I was like, I'm just going to make note of that because I thought, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good to know.
And then basically Annabeth is like, yep, time to run. And Echidna's like, oh, you got ahead of yourself, little precious baby. That's all right. We'll work on it. And the next shot we see is of the little chihuahua dog running down the hallway. And it was so cute.
We see like a normal family in their suite just like hanging out. They look out they hear all this rumbling and like metal clanging as it's being torn apart. And this little puppy just running down the hallway. I love these little bits of this is the mist at work, because they're handling it so well.
Yeah.
Like, the humans completely ignore, like, they hear the noises and they see a puppy and they go, okay, it must not be anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go back to their business. It's so well done.
Yeah, I love it. I really wish that we could have seen Echidna holding the dog, But I kind of also liked that it was in the carrier so that we got, like, the tail and we didn't need, like, the whole transformation in front of us.
It's definitely, like, a TARDIS carrier, by the way.
Yes.
That thing's got to be bigger in the inside.
Yeah, 100%. Also, I am always fascinated by the clever ways that television and movies, especially television because they're usually on tighter budgets, find ways to be really clever about hiding CGI transformations. I feel like this is kind of part of it. If you watch Teen Wolf, there are a lot of times when all you see is like a shadow instead of actually seeing the person transform. And that's to save money, but it can be done in really artistic and interesting ways.
Well, and it's also to protect your believability, because if they're trying to do it all on camera all the time so that you can see the transformation, if they don't have the money to really do that CGI justice, it can end up looking cheap and just pull you right out of the moment. Whereas just letting you see the shadow of it gives you the whole moment, but it doesn't punch you in the stomach with, this is CGI.
Yeah.
So, like, it's such a smart way to kind of keep that from getting out of control.
Yeah. And I think they kind of did that with Medusa a bit, because we didn't see her snakes for quite a while.
Very true.
And I think that was probably part of that, too.
Yeah.
And it adds an air of mystery to it.
It totally worked. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the train is starting to get destroyed, and it stops, and they hop off, and they know that they're being hunted. And so Annabeth leads them to the St. Louis Arch because it is a sanctuary. It is a temple to Athena. A demigod child of Athena built it in her honor, so they know that they can go there and be safe because no monsters can enter.
I love that Grover is like, there's an Athenian temple hidden in the middle of St. Louis. And she goes, well, yeah, except it's not all that hidden.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, we all know what's coming, but I love the little bits. And then you see in the puddle the reflection of the arch, and it's like,
yeah,
that's
it's that was just a cool shot.
It's a cool added little thing. And,
yeah.
And again, we'll explain things to viewers who don't know the book. Like, it's
right.
Just added fun for them.
Yeah. And I think the addition of that, because that's not what it's like in the book. So I thought that it was really cool that they decided to kind of go from the train to the arch and introduce it that way. And Annabeth starts reciting all of these fun facts about how tall and wide the arch is, how it stays standing, all that kind of stuff, because she loves architecture without telling us that she loves architecture. And I think you could, like, viewers who don't know might assume she just knows this because it's a temple to Athena, but I think it's still laying groundwork for her love of architecture.
Especially, like, she loves the fact that this is a monument to Athena built with math and symmetry at its heart, and that is one of the best ways to show your love for Athena is
yeah.
to take into account these things that keep this arch upright, is the equal force acting on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that sort of, like, you can see that she probably has all of the fun facts about all of these different temples that are all over the world that probably are looked at more as national monuments and blah, blah, blah. She's got it all filed away. And you just, you know, you hope she gets more and more opportunities to just let it all loose.
Yeah. I loved her line, "It's held up by math," which, as somebody who doesn't like math, I still appreciated that line. And it also, as an added bonus, is earthquake-proof, so Poseidon can't ruin it, which is just great. But I really liked what you said, and it made me realize, like, she specifically says, it is a monument to perfection. That's how you show Athena love. Is that why Annabeth loves architecture? Because it's to drive toward appreciating her mother?
I mean, I wouldn't say no.
Yeah, it's got to at least be a part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Grover is not as excited about the St. Louis Arch as Annabeth is, and he kind of mumbles something about it being a monument to something else. And I did not know this, but apparently underneath the St. Louis Arch, there is a museum called the Museum of Western Expansion, and there's also the Gateway Arch National Park, and a lot of this looks to be about Western Expansion and the buffalo and all of that kind of stuff, Native Americans and all of that. And he has a huge problem with what humans are doing to the wild. And he's really quite upset in this moment.
Yeah, he kind of has to take himself away from it because Annabeth is all about the intention of the builder.
Mm-hmm.
And the demigod who built this temple to Athena for a reason. And it doesn't matter what the humans are using it for. But all Grover can see is, yeah, well, this temple to Athena is being used to celebrate the, you know, how Americans have pushed westward and what they did to getting there and, you know, how the buffalo has been hunted almost to extinction and now it only exists in national parks and things like that. Like, all he can see is the devastation, not the intention behind the monument. And so they have a bit of a tiff. And
yeah.
Grover says, I'm going to go handle some other business so that you and I don't have to fight about this.
Yeah. And I just wrote down, Grover doesn't like Manifest Destiny, because he really doesn't. And he also has a great line in this scene where he says, just because we're prey doesn't mean we're helpless. And I mean, again, that's like Grover pushing back in a way that I don't think we see a whole lot in the books. And so I just really love this strength that Arian brings to the character.
And this is, again, that line is another thing that could have been attributed to Annabeth, could have been given to Annabeth.
Yeah.
Because what he's talking about is he's going to go try and get them train tickets and get back on the move. Like, they can't stay at the monument forever. They're going to hang out there long enough for Echidna to lose it, you know, to lose the scent or to get over it and want to move on because she can't keep her attention on them or whatever. He's like, we've got to keep planning, basically. And yeah, that could have 100% been an Annabeth line. But again, I like that they're giving some of that to Grover. He's, you know, he's used to being in the prey mindset. Like, I think he, you know, puts himself in the mindset
yeah.
of prey all the time and is thinking about the wilds and all of their, you know, everything that means.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I like this from Grover a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I like that he's getting a chance to share all the things going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, and if you think about it, this is a direct setup for season two. This is them getting ready to make him a junior searcher and send him out after Pan, which
yep.
is exactly what happens in season two. So,
and how much of that will we see?
Yeah.
Because now,
right, like, we might see, like, solo scenes of him searching and getting captured, like, things that we didn't necessarily see in the books because we were solely in Percy's point of view.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so ready for that. I love it. So, yeah, Grover goes off to buy more tickets to keep heading west. Annabeth kind of immediately realizes that she messes up. And Percy makes her laugh by pretending to be Athena and putting on this really terrible English accent. And it was so funny.
And then she, like, she's like, come on. Like, what are we doing?
After yeah.
And he's like, I have a gift.
Yeah.
And I just... I love that he thinks this is his gift.
Yeah.
This impressions his gift.
Yeah. Got but it's really nice to see Percy be a little silly because a lot's been going on. He's been very stressed out. He's been very sarcastic and snippy because that's his defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to make her laugh. And that's very nice. And she did laugh. And it's nice to see her smile, you know?
Yeah.
So I really liked that. And Percy kind of comments on, like, oh, you know, it's really lucky that we were in the right city where there was a temple right nearby. And Annabeth says, you know, is it luck or is it fate? And she kind of defends herself for believing in fate. And she kind of says, like, I know what you're thinking. You think that I believe in fate because it's easier to pretend that my mom cares that way. And Percy almost immediately says, like, don't listen to me. I've been a demigod since last Saturday. Like, I don't know anything.
Yeah, he's never had to think about fate the way demigods think
right.
about fate. He's never had an oracle give him a prophecy and had to think about what fate and luck and all of that means. So this is, you know, I feel like this is easy peasy for Annabeth to kind of grasp. But this is something Percy's never had to try and put into action or, like, really understand.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that she's kind of giving him things to think about. Like, you know, is it luck that we made it here? Or is this what was supposed to happen because we need to keep moving? Because we have to get to L.A. and have a chance at, you know, saving the world and keeping Zeus and Poseidon from fighting. Like, yeah. It's just, this is one step in the whole quest, mm-hmm. you know, chain of events.
And it's great foreshadowing because we know we're going to meet the Fates in the next episode.
Very true.
So they're probably going to have an even bigger discussion about what fate means and the fact that it's, there's an actual, like, person / people there to control fate.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that it's setting up for that. She also kind of turns this conversation back around on him, but again, it doesn't have the same sort of, like, venom that previous conversations had. And she's like, you know, we're in a temple. Like, we don't have to necessarily talk to my mom. We can talk to your dad. And Percy says he doesn't want to talk to his dad. He doesn't want anything from him. And you can kind of see how frustrated he is with his dad's absence.
Yeah, he literally says, like, my father had his chances. Like,
yeah.
He's had plenty of them. He never stepped in, never helped, and, mm-hmm. you know, never did anything. So, yeah, I like that she kind of gives him the moment to entertain the thought, like,
yeah.
We're in a temple. It's a temple. It might be to Athena, but it's still a temple, and it will be a great place for you to try if you want to. And it gives him a minute to just be like, no.
Yeah. And, you know, this conversation that they're having is very civil. And so Annabeth is like, careful, we might be becoming friends. You know, the Oracle is laughing at us.
Well, Percy stumbles over his words a little because he says, if I had to stick with someone, like,
yeah.
She's kind of bringing him to the, you know, like, you have to talk to your dad. Like, and he's like, no, I'm not giving my dad the time of day. If I have to stick with someone, And he kind of stops himself because he almost called her a friend, and she says something like, the Oracle's laughing at you right now.
Yeah.
Like, it's so playful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice step from adversaries or, you know, allies that clash to
grudging allies.
Yeah, they're working toward friendship, and we know in the next episode they're going to be going to Waterland, and we know what that means for these two. So, yeah, it's a nice kind of bridge moment to the possibility of friendship really starting to take root.
Yeah, and of course, it's then interrupted by Percy collapsing because he was poisoned by that barb from the Chimera. And so they throw him in the fountain outside the museum and start splashing him with water.
I made a note called Percy So Pale. That's all
yeah.
I said. Like,
he looks
really
bad. Yeah.
But yeah, them splashing him with water.
It was so funny. And he's just sitting there taking it, and you could tell he's, like, really uncomfortable.
And he's like, it's working, guys. It's working.
Yeah.
You can stop now. And, like, it's not working.
And he tries to get up and then falls back down, and they're just at a loss for what to do. And Annabeth kind of wonders, like, maybe it has to be fresh water.
Like, natural water, like, yeah.
Yeah. And, unfortunately, very bad timing now that they're outside the museum, Echidna approaches. And she speaks into Annabeth's mind, which we will get to in a little bit. But Annabeth sees Echidna and is willing to ask her mom for help, which is a huge change from what she previously...
Well, and she's willing to ask Athena for help to save Percy.
Yeah.
Which I think is just, it's the extra little bit on the top of it. It's like, she is willing to go to that length because now she can see that Percy is kind of pivotal and that he does have things that will be useful, and she needs him. So, yeah, love that.
Not only that, but I think she kind of likes the guy now,
you know?
Yeah. Like, they are becoming friends, and I think this episode, as short as it is, and as much as I think they could have packed more stuff into it, it really lays the foundation for, like you said, what's coming in the next episode, where they finally start to become actual friends.
Agreed.
And what Echidna said to Annabeth in her mind was that Athena is not going to help because their impertinence embarrassed her.
She claims it. She says, my impertinence
yeah.
wounded my mother's pride.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't Annabeth who sent it, Athena attributes it to Annabeth.
Yeah. And I do like that Annabeth claimed it, and I liked that Percy was like, but it was all me. I signed my name on the package. And Annabeth is like, yeah, but I didn't stop you. I let it happen. And so it's kind of this moment where, like, she could have been really mad at Percy, but, like, she's kind of taking responsibility, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked that, and I liked that he pushed back a little bit. Athena is not going to help them, and not only is she not going to help save Percy's life, she's gonna let Echidna into the building.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about the moment where Grover figures out what the monster is and names it as the Chimera.
Mm-hmm.
So they get to the top of the arch, and Annabeth pulls the alarm to clear it of any humans. And she kind of decides, like, all right, somebody's gotta stay behind and hold up Echidna and the Chimera so that two other people can keep going west, get to the underworld, get the bolt, figure all of this out. And she wants to do it. She volunteers herself. And so I kind of love this moment because, like, you can tell, like, you know, she doesn't really want to do this, but in her mind, like, it's the only thing that she can do. She wants to save their lives. She's willing to be a hero. She's willing to be like Thalia and sacrifice herself.
Yeah, and she knows that if Grover can get Percy to the water, his dad, or just the water, will heal him.
Yes.
They just have to get him to the natural water source, which the river is right there. It's just he has to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, if I can delay it long enough for you two to get to the water for Percy to heal, you can escape. And I, you know, whatever happens to me, happens to me. Like, you know. And, yeah, I think it does have a lot to do with, like, Thalia. She's thinking, like, they have to make it. Somebody has to get to L.A. Percy, in the shape he's in, isn't going to make it through this. And we don't know if me and Grover can get there. But if I'm able to stop this now, they have their best shot.
Yeah.
So, like, it's all happening in a moment, but, like, she's able to kind of reason the whole thing out.
Yeah. And Percy thanks her by offering her Riptide. But it's a trick. And he spins her around and shoves her into Grover's arms and closes and locks the door. And now he's the one that's facing off against Echidna and the Chimera. And I said this while we were watching. I was like, Annabeth was a little proud of him for that move. Like 100%.
Like panicking and like, you idiot. Like, yeah. You're not going to survive this. Are you crazy? But yeah, I think she begrudgingly respects. It was a good move.
Yeah, it really was. And they're pounding on the door, calling after him, telling him not to do it. And like you, I wrote down, Percy looks rough. And I underlined it twice.
Yeah.
He's so pale. I'm getting a little bit of Void Styles vibes from him. A
little bit.
Yeah, he's just so pale. He's got those dark circles under his eyes. His lips are pale and chapped. And you can tell he's dying. Yes. A slow death.
Oh, yeah.
And then my next line was, the Chimera is so cute.
I wrote, Dragon Kitty gets big mad when you try to stab her.
Oh, yeah.
That, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I will say, the CGI for the Chimera was stunning.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful creature. It's black and red with some yellow on it. It's just got a really interesting design.
And when you first see it from, like you see the horns first because the arch is rounded, so the horns are visible first and then you see the rest of the creature. And, like, from a distance, it almost looks like a furry, like, leopard. Like, the yellow kind of pops out. And the closer you get to it, the more you see, like, scales.
Yeah.
And it looks more like a, almost like a dragon face as opposed to that, like, feline look you kind of get from further back. And it's just incredible how they were able to make it look the way it does. And how, from one angle to another, it's got all kinds of different textures and colors to it that, yeah, absolutely stunning and very scary.
Yes, especially when it breathes fire and those, like, gills come out. Not gills, but, like,
the cobra flaps.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Like, they look like that really wide point of a cobra that when it's ready to strike, they, like, popped out from the side of its head. And
it was really cool. My one thing, which I'm not mad that they didn't do, but the whole thing with the Chimera was lion body, snake tail, like an actual snake for a tail, and a goat head protruding from its back. They did not do the goat head from its back, but they gave it, like, ram's horns.
Yeah.
I think it makes more sense that way.
Yeah.
It's a little bit less...
goofy?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I feel like they could have done a goat head, but it would have looked kind of like a periscope coming off the top
and
of
I
this
think,
dragon kitty.
And I feel like... the goat is what breathes fire. So, like, it would have been, like, a fire periscope from the middle of its back.
Oh, my God.
And it would have been ridiculous.
It would have been ridiculous.
Yeah, but the design is really beautiful.
However, if they ever do an animated Percy Jackson, like,
yeah.
in the future, I'm talking 50 years from now, I don't even know.
We have to still be alive, though.
Right? If they do an animated version, I want that goat breathing fire off the... Yeah, please. I absolutely need that.
Oh, it would be so funny. So, Echidna is the one who opens a hole in the bottom of the arch. And basically, the chimera, like, pushes him through. He holds on. He manages not to fall right away. Echidna has something sassy to say about, you know, like... somebody, like, nobody cares about you to give you a chance at surviving. She's very rude.
Mm-hmm.
And he does end up falling. And it's a little... My stomach lurched a little bit because it's, you know, we learned 630 feet in the air. It was a little scary. And the way the camera kind of rolls, like a phone falling out of something, and, you know, spinning around, I think they did a really good job with that.
You kind of start... above Percy's face, so he starts the fall and you're looking down, and then as he falls you see a long shot of him falling and then you see the tumbling, and it's enough to make you just like feel the gravity of the situation. It's the gravity. Okay, I'm done.
That's funny. So he does fall from the arch. And we see the water from the river spiral up and grab him. And you kind of pointed that out. You said, like, it looks like it reaches toward him.
Well, like, you know, we know that the river doesn't run under the arch. Like, when he falls out of the middle of the arch, he's falling onto the ground.
Yeah.
Like, you can see the grass under him.
I did not know that, but I've seen people make fun of Rick for him falling into the river when the river's not that close to where he would have fallen from the arch.
Well, like, I just mean, like, looking out from the arch, from above Percy, you can see the grass. Like, it's not a river. And even I was like, oh, that's gonna be a rough landing. Like, And I know that he's gonna somehow fall in the river. Like, I was curious how that was gonna happen. Like, was the water going to draw him toward it so he fell sideways out of it? Or I was kind of curious how this was going to work. And the water just kind of snakes up like a hand, reaches out to him, and pulls him in. And I think that's a pretty genius way to fix that problem.
Yeah, 100%. And it kind of falls into the next scene because I assume that was Poseidon grabbing him.
Yeah.
And so he falls into the river and he gets stuck. He can't breathe. He can't swim upwards. He is afraid that he's about to drown. And the Nereid visits him. And we can't really see her because, like you said, the river is very murky.
It's the Mississippi.
So. Yeah. And I was kind of bummed because I really wanted to see her face. I wanted to see, you know, her clothing, what she looks like. Although... given the way that this ends, it's very possible that we'll get a close-up of her in the next episode.
That was my thought, because there's more going on with this Nereid than what we saw. Like, that scene goes on longer. So I'm curious if, we won't get more in the next episode.
But again, that could be another good way to save CGI, is, like, not really show her up close and in detail.
Yeah.
And so the Nereid tells him to breathe, just like... he told his mother when she was panicking. So again, great full circle moment, and full circle in this idea of parents and children, because the Nereid mentions how proud Poseidon is of Percy, how hard it has been for him to stand back.
She says us.
Yes.
Which I thought was an interesting, like, it would have been easy to just say it's been really hard for him to stand back. She says us, which makes me, like,
it makes me feel warm and fuzzy.
The other sea spirits.
That there are all these sea creatures who have been watching him grow up and seeing him from Montauk. And, you know, like, it's been hard for all of them to stay back, not just Poseidon. I kind of liked that it included, like, all of these water spirits that are like, one day he'll know, and then we'll all be able to help and see and talk and, you know, like, I liked that a lot.
Yeah, me too. And she says, he's always been here, trust him. And Percy kind of relaxes for a second and then takes a deep breath and he can breathe underwater.
Hey!
Surprise! Son of Poseidon.
End of episode.
Yeah, so like both times, and especially the second time, when I knew when it was ending, I was still bummed out. Like, I really wanted more.
Yeah, so it's not a terrible place to end the episode because I see the appeal of he took his first breath underwater. He's just learning to calm down. Let's cut it here. And then the next episode starts in the water again and you can move on from there.
Like, yeah.
It makes some sense, but I just wanted the rest of that scene.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, maybe get the whole bit of the river, him get out of the river, Grover and Annabeth, like, being ecstatic that he's not dead, and go from there. Like, I wanted to see kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get it in the next episode.
Yeah.
It just didn't work here.
But that was episode 4. I think we still had a lot of stuff to talk about that episode. And, you know, it definitely gave us some really great moments that were different from the book. But I am so excited for episode 5 when we finally get to see Ares, the Tunnel of Love, Waterland, all of that. I think is going to be just fantastic.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, as much as we were looking forward to Medusa, and this episode has been a nice, you know, transition to that, I know we are all just very excited to see Ares and see how that all goes down. So yeah, it's gonna be so good. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. Tune into Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, and Threads at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that is a huge help. You can leave us questions, comments, or ideas for episodes or content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We have a bit of feedback from Twitter today to talk about, so I will throw it to Karen for that.
Yeah, so Updates Percy put out a little thing about what Arian said. His favorite monster scene for the trio to shoot was Krusty's waterbed shop. We got to lay in waterbeds all day. And I was so excited to hear this. We knew that this was probably going to be in the show. It's never been adapted before. And so I was just super excited because I just want to see what it's going to be like. And we had Sisypho at the Joao Roberto. Sorry. Who said, I was thinking about the interaction with Gladiola, the pink poodle, another day. It's a minor scene, but I'd like to know if it's adapted or referenced somehow in a new twisted way. And of course, we just talked about that, so that was actually really good timing. And I said that I was really curious about that too. And they replied, they may have actually skipped Gladiola and introduced this into the zoo animal truck instead, where we kind of get this idea that Grover can talk to animals, which is good. You know, that might be why they ended up skipping it.
Right, yeah.
We also put out a quote graphic for something that Rick said in the interviews where he just said, you know, I anticipate a lot of rewatching of the series. And A Bite Of podcast said, guilty of already watching it multiple times. Rick was right. I agree. When the premiere came out the other day, I immediately wanted to watch again. I'd already been thinking, like, I really want to watch them again. Like, I'm glad our screeners don't have limits. And it didn't get around to it, but, like, I had already wanted to just keep watching.
Yeah.
And then lastly, Demigod Disasters pod at Demigod Disaster said, I need the next season announced right now. And our friend, the damn meme page, quote tweeted it and said, place your bets, place your bets. I'm thinking somewhere between episodes 3 and 5. Any takers? And tagged a bunch of the podcasts to see what our guesses would be. And Return to Camp Half-Blood said, I'm a bet right before the finale. And I said, I'm going to say the day after the finale airs, it'll be announced because I don't want to get my hopes up that it's going to be sooner. So I was like, worst case scenario, the day after it airs. Camp Half Pod said, gotta go with an out of left field guess on Christmas. That would be a good Christmas
present. Yeah.
Hell Red Sky at Herographia said, I bet episode 5. Return to Camp Half-Blood said, I gotta see the premiere numbers before I can commit to a prediction. The Newest Olympian said, I'd say after episode 4, but before episode 5. Seaweed Brain Podcast said, episode 4, because that'll be 3 weeks in / the mid-season finale. And the Demigod Pod said, I think it will be episode 4, because that will be the halfway point. So, Kristen, you want to weigh in? What are you feeling here?
Okay. I might be a little bit controversial, but I think we're going to get it sooner than we think.
Okay.
I think Disney is going to see the numbers after episode... I think they're going to see the numbers after episode 3 for the first 2 and see how much it's been rewatched. They're going to see the clamoring for it. And I think we're going to get it, like, either right before episode 3 or right after.
Okay.
I think it's going to be soon. I could just be wishful thinking. But I really think, like, they're already planning on it. And, you can feel that in the writer's room already getting prepped. And them putting so many, like, little very small references to things that we're going to see and, like, grounding these, you know, the trio and making sure that we're already kind of playing with Pan and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
I just feel like they have faith in it already. They just are holding back on giving us that official green light until everybody's paying attention, which is why I think we may get it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. I think on the one hand, that does make sense because they'll probably want to see what the drop is between people watching episodes 1 and 2 and people watching episode 3.
Possibly.
To see how much follow-through they have. On the other side of that equation is how much they have ready of season 2 because of the writer's strike, they had to stop. Mm-hmm. So we might have to wait a little bit longer before they see what their plans are for season 2 because it's not just about how well season 1 does, even though that's going to play a big part. It's them wanting to see what they're going to do with season 2 and decide, yes, we like the direction you're going in, keep going.
I don't know. Once you have a show that exists like this, like, that it's definitely part of breaking the story when you're doing season 1. Like, I feel like it's vital for them to see the direction they're taking and really get an idea before they greenlight it. When you're doing, like, season 2, I feel like you already have an idea of where the story's
going. You have a little bit of faith.
Yeah. So I want to say that it's going to be less important for them to see the whole roadmap. Like, maybe the writers have... you know, can give them an episode breakdown of, like, here's the major beats for each episode. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it's going to be more related to, yes, this is exactly as popular as we thought it was going to be, and we've got the faith.
Well, do you think that budget talks could play into that? I mean, that could be a reason why they need to know what exactly is planned for season 2.
I mean, it's... money talks, so I'm sure that's part of the discussion, especially, you know, if they look at how much they had to spend on the first season with CGI and everything. But again, if it gets people on to Disney Plus who weren't there before or who left and are willing to come back for this, it's worth it for their bottom line. So, yeah, again, it might just be wishful thinking, but I think we may find out earlier than we would have imagined. And I'm sticking to that. Probably wrong.
Well, hopefully you're right. I don't want to wait.
Right, me neither. But I do think that all the predictions about it being right around the finale, right after the finale, you know, I don't think you're wrong. There's a strong chance of that just because they may want season one to play itself out for people not to get ahead of themselves or, you know. So it's also a possibility. So that wraps up this episode. Next week, we will be talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, episode 5, and our discussion episode will go live on January 10th, so keep a lookout for that. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.